From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We thank you for your support every week. We do that not in a perfunctory way, but because we are truly grateful for your support. Today, as the world around us changes in unsettling and unexpected ways, it really is more important than ever to provide this platform for thoughtful, respectful dialogue and voices that all too often go unheard. For more information on how you can keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, at the intersection of religion, government, and politics, an Oklahoma state lawmaker has raised eyebrows with his religious defense of a popular bill that would outlaw the termination of pregnancies based on fetal genetic abnormalities. Representative George Fought said that even in pregnancies that result from rape or incest, quote, God can bring beauty from ashes. Meanwhile, at the federal level, a bill with bipartisan support has been introduced that increases the federal penalty for bomb threats and other threats of violence against religious institutions. Since existing laws already convey hate crime status unto such acts, many are viewing this new legislative initiative as redundant pandering to special interest groups. And while this year's American-Israel Public Affairs Committee Policy Conference drew some 18,000 pro-Israel activists for 3 days of speeches, workshops, and lobbying visits to Capitol Hill, notably absent were both President Donald Trump and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Unfortunately, the budget that we're inheriting is a mess. Our moral duty to the taxpayer requires us to make our government leaner.
Deep cuts to government programs that help the poor and the needy may be politically popular right now, but are they moral? Advocating for values to be a key part of any budget decisions in the network lobby. And we'll get the thoughts of Executive Director Sister Simone Campbell later in this week's show.
Donald Trump, would my son, Captain Humayun Khan, have a place in your America? Would Muslims have a place in your America?
With just days to go until the Interfaith Alliance Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards on April 4th in Washington, D.C., we'll spend a few minutes revisiting our interview last year with one of the heroes, Gold Star Dad Kesar Khan. The other award recipient is longtime public radio legend Diane Rehm. You'll find complete details at interfaithalliance.org. With Easter and Passover both less than 2 weeks away, we'll also revisit a 2013 conversation with interfaith family advocate and author Susan Katz Miller. But first,
from 9/11 to the recent British terror bust, most of the terrorists we have faced have been Muslim extremists and of Arab descent. That's not an opinion, it is fact.
A number of minority groups have been feeling that they're in the political and cultural crosshairs in this country. It's hard to deny that the way the last election played out has contributed to an atmosphere that has left many, including religious minority groups, feeling attacked and vulnerable. For one look at the statistics behind the broader assumptions, the 2017 American Muslim Survey from the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding is an important resource, and I'm joined now by Research Director Daya Magahed Dalia, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
This is the second comprehensive survey of American Muslims that you've done. Were you looking to assess anything particular this year?
When we were doing this research, we wanted to get a pulse on how different faith communities were feeling after the results of the 2016 elections. And we also wanted to look at specifically the Muslim community in terms of their own political and social challenges. So oftentimes with a community that feels so under siege, we don't pay enough attention to the struggles that they're facing internally, not just from social forces outside of their community. So we looked at things like domestic violence, like intra-community racism. We didn't just focus on what was happening to Muslims from the outside, but what was going on inside the community as well. And what was really special is we did that across the board, so we always have comparisons, and we can ask the question, are Muslims exceptional, or are they human American citizens that suffer from the same social ills as everyone else?
What are some of the most noteworthy findings from the 2017 survey?
Well, I think the big story out of this study is that Muslims are the most negatively impacted faith community in America post-2016 elections, and actually even before. But Muslims are the most likely to say that they have faced religious discrimination of any other faith community. Most alarming is that it's even impacting children. Nearly 50% of Muslim families with school-age children report that their child has been bullied in school for their faith. And even more alarming, one in four of the times, it involves a teacher or administrator in actually bullying the child, that it's the teacher doing the bullying. So it's a very serious issue around this climate. This climate is impacting human beings in very real ways, and it's resulting in mental health struggles of people feeling so much anxiety and fear, that so much that they say that they need to actually seek counseling. You have people who feel so scared that they have even made plans to leave the country if it becomes necessary. So I think the story, the really major story that came out of this poll is that we have to take the rhetoric and the policies that we've been enduring over the past 2 years very seriously, because they're impacting families, American families, in a very serious way.
Are there noteworthy trends or changes compared to last year?
There were a few trends that we found. One is that there has been an uptick in American Muslim voter registration. A little over 300,000 additional voters have been registered in the Muslim community. It's an increase of 8%, which is by no means trivial. So the last year of mobilizing and trying to get people out there has had an impact, but still Muslims are less likely than other faith communities to have registered or voted in the last election, primarily because of a lack of enthusiasm for either candidate.
Did any of the findings really surprise you?
There were some surprising findings. I was surprised by the level of bullying, quite frankly. I didn't know, and I didn't realize how severe it was. Nor did I realize that a quarter of the time a teacher or administrator was involved. That was alarming. Another thing that surprised me, though, was how people seemed to be responding to prejudice. So I mentioned the discrimination and the bullying and some of these things, but the way people are responding as well is also by increasing their civic engagement. A quarter of Muslims say that in response to the election, they started volunteering or contributing to a civic organization that they hadn't before. Mm-hmm. There's also a great deal of solidarity with other marginalized groups. So Muslims are the most likely faith group to say they support Black Lives Matter. Now, a quarter of Muslims are black, so these are not two mutually exclusive groups at all. But that does not explain their support. Asian Muslims also support Black Lives Matter at equal levels to black Muslims. And even other race groups within the Muslim community support Black Lives Matter much higher than the general public. So some of these things really surprised me. I wasn't sure what I'd find in terms of how people were responding to the current climate.
What impact on the Muslim community is this whole Muslim ban initiative of the administration? How is that impacting?
There's direct and indirect impacts. The direct impacts are that people are in limbo. Families have been broken apart. In some cases, children can't be reunited with parents. I mean, it's a very serious issue in terms of the direct impact on Americans with families that are of other citizenships included in this ban. The indirect impact is that Muslims feel singled out. They feel that they are criminalized as a community, and that alienation is very detrimental. It's also creating psychological space and license for hate, and sometimes that hate becomes violent. We have found an astronomical uptick in hate crimes targeting Muslims and other people of color as well.
What is it going to take to get rid of this bias? I mean, is there some big event that's got to take place, or how are we going to get rid of it?
It's not going to be a big event. It'll be slowly and surely. We get rid of bias by first being aware that they exist. Being aware of our implicit bias is actually a very powerful way to get rid of bias, and research has shown that. The second way that we get rid of bias is through education and exposure. So getting to know a Muslim does, of course, help, and we should try to get to know people that we are unfamiliar with and may harbor prejudice against. But the third way, and I think this is perhaps one of the most important, is for the media to start being objective, to start doing its job to inform the public rather than to disinform the public. And if the media continues to be so biased, one study found that 90% of news coverage on Islam and Muslims is negative, not neutral, but negative in terms of its tone and its content. And the more that we consume negative media, the more we are going to continue to make decisions based on bias rather than facts.
Yeah. Daya Magahed is Research Director at the Institute for Social Policy, which has just released its 2017 survey titled American Muslims at the Crossroads. We'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. Thanks so much for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
In 2013, journalist Susan Katz-Miller published an important book titled Being Both, Embracing Two Religions in One Interfaith Family. With Passover and Easter both drawing near, I wanted to revisit a few highlights from that conversation. How has it been living in a family practicing two different religions?
The biggest drawback that families talk about is the necessity of having to explain yourself all the time.
Mm-hmm.
What we find really helpful is that we have formed these communities in the major cities, in Washington, in New York, in Chicago. There are communities that have formed Sunday schools, religious education programs for these children, where they learn both religions side by side. And that also really helps kids with their sense of self-esteem and the sense that they're doing something that is not marginal or different.
Mm-hmm.
What I did for this book was, rather than just writing about my own family, I surveyed parents and teens and young adults who grew up in these interfaith programs. And what I was seeing is that the young people who went through these interfaith education programs often feel strongly that they want to keep both, mm-hmm. and that they don't feel that that's immature, that they feel like they get benefits from both. Some of them do choose a single religion.
Mm-hmm. Celebrating both Judaism and Christianity would be good for holidays because the holidays have somewhat compatible themes and that kind of thing. What was the biggest challenge between distinguishing the two religions within the home?
One of the biggest challenges is burnout, because if you try to celebrate the full set of two holidays, it's almost like you're in a continuous holiday mode.
Yeah.
And it gets exhausting, and you do have to pick and choose, but every family picks mm-hmm. and chooses, mm-hmm. and every religion has a process of curating, you know, which rituals are going to be considered obsolete and which are going to be the most compelling and which are the most important to preserve. That process goes on continuously. In my family, I think certainly my children enjoyed all of the holidays. Our family tries hard to go beyond the obvious of Hanukkah and Christmas, mm-hmm. Easter and Passover. I'm very aware that families who do both are sometimes accused of doing nothing, and we are trying to be sort of maximalists rather than minimalists. And so we do not just Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah in the fall, but Sukkot and Simchat Torah. But we also celebrated the blessing of the animals in mm-hmm. honor of St. Francis. Mm-hmm. My kids have a great-great-grandfather who was a circuit-riding rabbi in the 19th century in Mississippi and Louisiana, mm-hmm. serving small Jewish communities on the river. I want my children to grow up knowing that story and understanding what it means to be a rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
They also have a great-great-grandfather who was an Episcopal bishop of Newark.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't imagine raising them in a way such that they don't understand what it means to be an Episcopalian and to mm-hmm. be a bishop and the significance of that ancestor.
Susan, is there something in this book that you really wanted to talk about that I haven't asked you and given you a chance to talk about?
One point I wanted to bring up, and this is perhaps more subtle, is that there's a lot of interfaith activism and interfaith dialogue going on, especially since 9/11. And this is great. It's very important for our world. And these are events and conversations that you often take one Christian, one Jew, one Hindu, one Muslim, and have them engage in conversation or do community service together. That's all great. But there's been a sort of an invisible wall between that conversation and the interfaith families conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes interfaith families are seen as threatening because they are bridging these barriers that we're trying to put up. And the ambiguity is hard sometimes for religious institutions to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
I'm making the argument in this book that people from interfaith families, whether they're intermarried or they're interfaith children, actually have tremendous skills in building those bridges. They live day and night, 24/7, in these interfaith conversations, and they have a lot to contribute to interfaith peacemaking. And
mm-hmm.
I would like to see some of these young interfaith adults coming up be part of that interfaith conversation.
That's a great point.
Talking to these children in particular is very exciting because they are so articulate about their place as ambassadors, people who can sit with a friend who's Jewish, a friend who's Christian, a friend who's Muslim, and help that group to function. They have those skills of cross-cultural, cross-faith communication.
Mm-hmm.
I was hoping that's what I would find, and I did find it. And
Good.
The book is filled with the stories of these children, of these couples, and
Good.
All of those examples are, of course, very encouraging to me.
In addition to her book, Being Both, Embracing Two Religions in One Interfaith Family, Susan Katzmiller is a popular public speaker and writer on interfaith family issues. This year, she's assembled a useful guide to holiday celebrations across the country that welcome multi-faith families, and we'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. Sister Simone Campbell is Executive Director of the Network Catholic Lobby. As the original nun on the bus, Simone has pioneered the kind of on-the-ground activism that we've seen bring attention to key public policy issues in recent months. With debate around federal budget issues growing louder all the time, I wanted to get her perspective on how key moral components of the budget are likely to fare. And so I'm delighted to welcome Sister Simone back to State of Belief Radio. It's always great to talk with you, and I appreciate you being with us again today.
Oh, it's always an honor, Weldon. Thanks for the opportunity.
You've focused attention on the moral aspects of the federal budget in recent years, even before the level of cut-at-all-cost rhetoric reached the pitch that it has now. So how bad is it looking right now?
Well, I have to say that I could get accused of being Chicken Little saying the sky is falling, the sky is falling. But I'm afraid this time the sky fell. And what we have to be really keenly aware of that we learned in the healthcare fight is that we the people can raise it up again. Because what's happening in the president's proposals are a decimation of the key domestic programs that make our country viable, that support we the people, and a shifting of all of that savings either into tax cuts for the wealthy or into the military and the internal military in our nation in the immigration fight of creating an internal, they're enhancing the internal force in our nation to round up folks, hardworking folks who are integral to our communities. And so what we the people know, though, is that we the people can make the difference. Mm-hmm. We can change this.
What is most at risk from your perspective?
The shocking thing is my list is quite long, but what we're focusing on at Network are really four key things. The first is with regards to this shift of money to the immigration force, the ICE patrols, immigration and customs enforcement folks, to hire an additional, I believe it's 50,000 more, and to then make our cities and our countrysides places of basically military, internal military operations. This has got to be stopped. The second piece is the housing issue in our nation, which is actually, I think, one of the reasons I'm most upset about this is that I thought our president would get the idea of building, that if we don't have housing for our people, our nation suffers. But the proposal right now is to cut the Section 8 housing, which is not nearly enough for the needs of our nation. It's additionally to eliminate the community development block grants. Now, community development block grants are a great Republican program because what they do is they give money to the local level for the local level to choose how to use. And this is all their idea that the local level can decide. Well, they're going to zero it out, which means a lot of job training programs, a lot of transportation programs, a lot of the housing first, they're going to eliminate. And then additionally with housing, they want to eliminate the support for paying for utilities. And the fact is that low-wage workers cannot afford utilities, and they want to zero it out. So housing is a key issue. Healthcare, we've got to make sure it's fully funded. We won one battle, but we have to make sure it's fully funded. And then finally, the census. Now, the census is a sleeper topic. And what people don't realize is that it's mandated by the Constitution that every 10 years we count the people in our nation. But so much of federal funding gets determined by the count. And so if we don't count all our people, then our states suffer, our localities suffer. So we've got to make sure that there's an effective count. Now, that was a lot, but I have a lot of passion about this thing. But we the people can do this. It's not rocket science. We can do this.
What kind of mind, what kind of vision of our country drives the kind of budget that we're looking at?
Oh, that is a good question. I've really thought about this quite a bit, and I think two things are driving it. The first is money, that the definition of winning is giving more money to people at the top. And this idea that tax cuts, contracts, all this should go to the wealthy is a continuation of the failed trickle-down economics that we've had for the last almost 40 years. Mm-hmm. And the focus on a failed policy, they've got this idea they just need to double down. But you know, the other piece that's behind this is an effort to solidify the Republican Party. And the Republican Party is actually, I think, at least two, if not three parties right now. Mm-hmm. And their effort to hold themselves together is creating this very divisive policies. Mm-hmm. Because there's the group that doesn't want government spending, so this cutting the budget is about giving the Freedom Caucus a cut to government. Mm-hmm. There's a group of businesses that want better tax benefits so that they can get more revenue. And then there's a group of Republicans and those are the big business folks, and then there's a group of Republicans that are about small business. Mm-hmm. And so this budget really reflects the divided Republican Party, and it doesn't reflect the people. That's the problem.
You know, and I think that's a very important discussion, even if it stands alone. I'm also connecting that to a very pragmatic question, which I want to ask now, and that is, what arguments are the most likely to be effective in the current political climate? There was a time when we've stood together and talked about the budget from a moral perspective. I'm not sure moral arguments count for much in this budget.
In a nation where truth seems to be lacking in the conversation, you may have a point, but it doesn't mean we're not going to make it.
Right.
And this is the thing that I've found around the country, is that people are hungry for an alternative vision, mm-hmm. for an alternative that says you're not alone, I have your back. And that's the key piece that we're lifting up in D.C., is that a faithful budget is a budget that cares for the constitutional mandate to be we the people. Mm-hmm. We the people of the United States, not I the corporation or I the rich one, I the politician, we the people. Now, the thing that we learned with healthcare is that people make a difference. Mm-hmm. And the number of calls that our little organization got in, over 4,000 calls to the House of Representatives in 3 days. But it's because the people cared, mm-hmm. and that made a difference. It's harder to care about the budget because it comes up every year, and it's sort of like, oh, my gosh, too complicated, it's only dollars. No, it's our people. Mm-hmm. So what we're going to do is to lift up the moral story, lift up the moral voice in our interface setting, and then we're going to get our people to call. Mm-hmm. So call early, call often, put your member of Congress on speed dial. Please call. You can do this. We can use our voices to either present the moral story or intimidate our politicians. I'm not above that.
Yeah. So if I ask where are you focusing your efforts, you would say on members of Congress and people who are activists. Would that be right?
Right. Members of Congress on the committees, but also then we need all of our members of Congress, but not everybody's called to the lobbying side of it as I am, I know. But we all have a piece to play, so we can talk to our neighbors about this. We can say how worried we are. We can write letters to the editor. We can engage in discourse in our churches, synagogues, mosques. We can create a community that we hunger for, mm-hmm. and then create legislation out of that community. And that's where we need to do the building, but everybody has a part. My part happens to be this, but everyone has a piece to play in making our nation better. So I think if we all stand up and do our part, we can stop this harm.
Well, you've alluded already to the fact that there's been some encouraging reporting coming out regarding the growing influence of progressive voices of faith in the current political environment. Whom are you working in coalition with to make sure this happens?
Well, the coalition is growing rapidly, but in D.C., we're working with the interfaith community, the Washington Interfaith Staff Community, on the faithful budget. We're also working in coalition with our secular colleagues at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities and a wide group called the Coalition for Human Needs. I mean, they have over 250 organizations involved in it, and we are glad for the opportunity to collaborate broadly, and we know that our faith voice is essential in that conversation.
Simona, are there other issues beyond the budget that the current political climate has compelled you and your colleagues to engage in?
Yes, well, these days it's sort of like drinking from a fire hose. It's quite a challenge. Well, healthcare has been our big first fight, and I'm so glad at the result. We've got to keep our eyes on it, and we have to keep our eyes on regulation because much of the Affordable Care Act is implemented through regulation, and we have to make sure that, one, regulations stay in place, and two, that they are followed and enforced. So that's going to be one key issue. Additionally, what we have to see is that at the heart of all of our issues is this issue of income and wealth disparity, and that too many of our hardworking families are being left behind because of flat wages. And so we're working at both trying to lift up the issue of living wages and a family-friendly workplace, and Ivanka Trump actually has spoken about the importance of a family-friendly workplace. So we're hoping we can find some coalition there to get some movement going. We're looking for every opportunity we can to reduce the income and wealth disparity in our nation. And using the lens of race and ethnicity in our nation is to look and see how communities of color are really more adversely impacted by our discriminatory policies. So we're working with a broad coalition to make this happen. But I'll tell you, when you've got so many fires to fight, it's hard to move forward our proactive agenda, but it's still there.
Tell our listeners what they need to be doing right now to get more informed and to stay engaged around these issues.
Well, I'd urge all your listeners to come to our website, networklobby.org. That's networklobby.org. And we have digested weekly what's going on in Congress and how we can make change. Additionally, there's a little button there that you can say take action. And once you've registered on your computer will recognize you, or our computer, I guess it is, recognizes you going forward. And we send alerts weekly about the most important action to take. Usually it's an email. Sometimes it's a phone call. I will say in these urgent actions ahead, phone calls are going to be the most important. Mm-hmm. Emails help, but phone calls are really important. And the third best, the absolute best, is visit your member of Congress. Get to know him or her and engage them in conversation. They are part of we the people, and we the people need to make our needs known. And so by joining us, we can give you hints, we can give you resources, we can give you summaries, easy-to-read summaries of what's going on. But there's a lot of other fine organizations. Pick one. You can't do them all. Just pick one, maybe two, follow them, engage, and do your part. We need you.
What keeps you going? Where are you drawing hope from?
Oh, I'm drawing hope from all of the people that I meet. I was just at Boston College and told a story about Margaret, who I tell often about someone who died because she didn't have health care. And she said, Margaret's been my fuel for Medicaid expansion and health care reform. And a man came up to me and told me that his brother had a similar story. He died in 2002 because he was an independent contractor and didn't have health care and died of colon cancer. when I know that we share these stories, we share a common truth, then that is at the source of my energy. But it's taking it, for me, it's taking it to meditation and prayer to have something new break open. And what I try is to hold all these people who are in my broken heart, but broken hearts release joy into the universe. And so I'm trying to hold them and stay faithful to the call. For me, it's the call of the gospel. Mm-hmm. It could be the call of the Constitution to do the best we can for each other. So with others in community, how can I not keep going?
Sister Simone Campbell is executive director of the Network Catholic Lobby, an activist, attorney, faith leader, and poet. Sister Simone is also the author of the important book, A Nun on the Bus, How All of Us Can Create Hope, Change, and Community. Simone, these are trying times. I so appreciate knowing that you're doing what you're doing, and it's great having you with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Always an honor, Weldon. Thank you so much. Keep doing your part, too, and we can do it together.
It seems so long ago now when attorney and Gold Star Father Kezar Khan made headlines at the 2016 Democratic National Convention. Since his moving words on that day, directed at the now President of the United States, Khan has continued to speak out in defense of the kind of pluralism this nation was built on and which seems so undervalued in many parts of the nation today. We were fortunate to have Mr. Khan with us on State of Belief last year. And as Interfaith Alliance prepares to honor him and veteran broadcaster Diane Rehm this Tuesday in Washington, D.C. with the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award, I'd like to revisit that conversation from November of 2016. You made a simple but very powerful point at the Democratic National Convention. I wish you would just summarize that point.
The purpose of going to the convention was to pay tribute to our son, but prior to accepting that invitation, we would visit our friends and their children would ask us the question about being thrown out of this country and not being interested in studies and worried and not eating well, not sleeping. So that had bothered us, and that is what was expressed in that speech. At the bottom of our heart and behind all of that humble speech and speaking and waving the Constitution was care for others, that my faith and other faiths have taught us that in this life our Creator assigns all of us care of others. So we spoke with that in the back of our mind.
Mm-hmm. When did you become so knowledgeable of and devoted to the Constitution?
Well, I'll tell you, I was an undergrad student in Pakistan when I took a course called Comparative Study of the Constitution of the World. I read the Constitution in that course of Soviet Union, of Germany, Magna Carta for British system, and Constitution of United States. At that early age, I could not pass without my eyes welling and my hands trembling when I read the Declaration of Independence, the difficulties that this nation had gone through to come together to gain its independence, very similar to a few hundred years afterwards. We had the same difficulty in gaining our independence. And that caught my attention and my interest. So I had been a student of the history of the United States and its Constitution ever since. I am not a constitutional lawyer or a scholar. I am a mere student of Constitution. But it means so very much. I have read it again and again. And I am so honored to be living and receiving the goodness of this country, goodness of this nation, under the foundation of the values enshrined in constitutions.
What do you think many of the American people don't understand about Islam that they need to understand in order to provide all people the same rights, privileges, and freedoms that you understand should already be guaranteed?
We are testament to the goodness of America. Most America understands their values, understands this equal dignity to all and consideration of all faiths equal. It is only a small number, a minority, that has gotten the definition of Muslims and Islam through some unfortunate events that have taken place, regrettably some violence, regrettably some activities by a small number of Muslims. I cannot exclude them. My religion doesn't allow me to exclude them from faith, but they have practiced violence and the act of violence on innocent people that is against the spirit of my religion. So I implore my brothers and sisters in the United States to look beyond that. They have hijacked, because of their limited understanding of their own faith, all this violence, all this terrorist activities outside the United States and here is not part of my faith. My faith says, and this is part of the last sermon of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and he said, hurt no one and you will not be hurt. He insisted on equal dignity of all faiths, and that Muslims are bound to must treat all other faiths with equal dignity. Somehow, this small number of people in other parts of the world have totally misunderstood or intentionally ignored the peaceful teaching of my faith.
How have you handled the backlash that you've experienced, your wife faced? How do you continue speaking out as you do and knowing those critics are there?
Sir, we are fully cognizant of that. But I tell you this, and I gain strength from people like yourself, sir, and your audience. There are more good people in this country than those that have limited vision of the leadership of this country. So whenever we meet, whenever we are on streets, aeroplane, airports, personally folks are reaching out to us, sending us letters of encouragement. There are only a handful of letters of discouragement, and we can identify that letter as soon as it arrives. The sender will not put his or her name on return address and will not put their name at the bottom of the letter. And that speaks to the moral courage of that gesture of dislike, gesture of hatred. On the other hand, the people that are encouraging us to continue with our message of emphasizing the goodness of this country, the values of this country, is such a enormous number. Our tables are full. We are receiving presents and gifts of scripture, prayers highlighted in Bible, the texts, Old Testament, New Testament, Holy Quran. They're just amazing outpouring of love. So we are heartened that we should continue our journey in the goodness of this country, but we extend the hand of understanding their point of view as well. They are our brothers and sisters, and the reconciliation cannot begin without extending an open heart and open courtesy and open acceptance of their point of view, but holding hand, as common mission is to live, survive happily under the foundation, under the goodness of this country. So we are heartened, in fact, and we will continue our message, which is that now that the elections are going to be over, the whole country needs to come together, remove the division, and realize the problems. There are some genuine issues. There are some genuine problems, and the dialogue should begin. I was reading the difficulties, the history, and the dialogue that took place when our Constitution was being framed, when our Bill of Rights was being framed. What a difficulty our forefathers had, disagreements they have had. But at the bottom of their hearts and at the bottom of their struggle was goodness for the country, goodness for the nation. and how to set the wonderful foundation that we continue to enjoy even today. So I remind everybody that this Constitution, the values that we cherish so much, didn't come together without little difficulty. There had been disagreements, arguments, to a level much greater than what we face today. But at the end of the argument was that we wish our country well, we wish our nation well. Let's come together and continue the dialogue, and through dialogue we deal with our differences. Muslims are as patriotic as in Arlington Cemetery. Whenever I go to pay a visit to my son, Captain Humayun Khan, there are five other Muslims right next to one another in the cemetery, Section 60. They're all Muslims. They're Gold Star families that come there, and we meet them. And there are others as well that come there. We are all for the defense of this country, for the defense of the values of this country, and defense of this nation. And there are about 5,000 active duty serving Muslims in the armed forces that defend this country on a daily basis. And the nation is realizing, slowly and gradually, this nation is, and this country is realizing the contribution that we all equally continue to make, regardless of our faith.
The 2017 Interfaith Alliance Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards Ceremony in Washington, D.C. is this Tuesday. We'll be celebrating the lifetime of work journalist Diane Rehm has shared with her listeners in Washington, D.C. and around the country. We'll also be honoring attorney, constitutional advocate, and Gold Star dad Kesar Khan. The reception and award ceremony is Tuesday, April 4th at the Mitchell Gold Bob Williams downtown Washington location. In addition to honoring two exemplary Americans, this is also an important fundraiser for Interfaith Alliance. Complete details are available at interfaithalliance.org. That date again, this Tuesday, April 4, 2017. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. We're counting on you now more than ever, and quite frankly, so are many listeners who aren't able to find the voices that we amplify week after week anywhere else. If you've heard something that you've found to be helpful, for goodness sakes, I urge you to share that with others who also might benefit. It's easy to do that on Facebook and Twitter. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. That's stateofbelief.com. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. Be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.